Today, we interview Jesse Liberty. He has 2 decades of experience as a programmer, teacher, and an author. Right now, he works for Microsoft and is writing a Silverlight 2 book called Programming Silverlight 2 with Tim Heuer. Today, Jesse joins us to talk about templating. But the best part, Jesse's going to be a regular guest on the Sparkling Client podcast.
Jesse just gives us a tour of the entire gamut of that world.
Great. Well, let's listen to the interview now.
Jesse Liberty, thank you once again for joining us on the Sparkling Client podcast.
Eric, I am incredibly pleased to be here.
Well, we are very excited about having you as a regular guest on this podcast.
Well, I have to say, this is an extraordinary opportunity because, first of all, I think that your show is really gaining traction in the community, and it allows me the opportunity to be a podcaster without doing any of the work. So I'm a happy guy.
Outstanding. Well, I think it could work out well for everyone, especially the listeners. So shall we get down to it? Templating. I'm hoping that you can take us on this tour of what templating means in Silverlight and a little bit of how it's done from a conceptual level. How does that sound?
That sounds great. Let's talk about some of the confusion first among various related concepts. And the concepts would be the idea of attributes and styles and templates and custom controls and dependency properties. All of these concepts are closely related and they tend to get thrown together, and it's worth taking them apart and approaching them in a more or less systematic way, because some of them you use every day, some of them you use in a little bit more advanced approach, and some of them you use only when you get to the point where you decide that you need to create your own custom controls. Custom controls, I would say, is at the top of that pyramid.
The pyramid being the difficulty to implement and the sort of exceptionality of actually doing that implementation?
Yes, and also that it builds on all of the other concepts, that in order to create custom controls, you really need to understand all of the rest. So if I may, I'll start at the most fundamental. When you're building a Silverlight application, you are working typically in 2 programming languages at once. You're working in XAML, which is the markup, and you're working in code. And it is certainly true that the code that you're working in may be any number of different languages. I would divide that code into 2 approaches. One would be managed code, and the other would be dynamic interpreted or scripted code. And I'm going to restrict my conversation to the case where you're working in managed code. So let's say that we're talking about either VB or C sharp to keep the conversation simple. When you're writing your XAML, each XAML statement can be thought of as an element with attributes. And each object in XAML, so if you say button width equal 150, height equal 200, that would be an ugly button, and text equal hello, click me. Each of those XAML objects can be thought of as an element with its attributes, and each of those corresponds to a CLR object with properties.
Now, this is a really important point, I think. So we have this XAML that sort of looks a little bit like a tree, right? We have sub-elements and sub-elements of those sub-elements, and we can think of that as maybe also an object tree of, as you say, CLR objects.
Right. In Silverlight 2, as opposed to 1, anything that you declare in your XAML, in fact, by the very act of putting it in your XAML file and saving that file, it becomes implicitly declared in your class, and you can refer to it by the name that you gave it in the XAML. So if I say, if you can imagine this, and I won't do a lot of code in the air, but if you can imagine, I say angle bracket button x colon name equal my button, and then I give it some attributes. You know, I give it text, and I give it width, and I give it height, and so on. I can then save that file, and in the associated.cs file, I can just use that button. I can say my button.width equal 75. And at runtime, that will dynamically change the width of that button. I don't have to declare that button in the CS file. It already exists because I put it in the XAML file. That's point A. Point B is that any object that I declare in XAML has a corresponding object in the CLR. So we start there. Now, one way that you can modify the look of that button is by setting the attributes of the button. And those attributes correspond to the properties of the class. Now, where did that class come from? Well, the starting point here, and we tend not to think about this, is that all of those controls, now this is a subset of all the objects in the CLR that we think of as controls, and that's because they inherit from the base class control, which actually I think it's which inherits from UI element, if I'm remembering properly, which inherits from, I think it's
framework
UI
element.
I think framework element inherits from UI element, actually. We could look up the hierarchy. But the bottom line here is we have controls, and under controls we've got buttons and checkboxes and radio buttons and so on. All of those were created by some programmer at Microsoft.
So what you're saying then is this world that we're used to of CLR objects, right, if we're .NET programmers, that ties directly into this world we're programming against in Silverline.
Yes, but the key thing here is that the controls that are available to you as a Silverline programmer are not the exact same controls that were available to you in ASP or WinForms. And there's a key difference in the design of the controls in Silverlight, which is that when the controls in Silverlight were created, they were consciously created with a division between the logic of the control on the one hand and the look of the control on the other. And that division was created so that every single control is, by its nature, lookless. And by that I mean you can change the fundamental look of that control. That means that you can change its default appearance, and you can change the way it looks in its various states. Now, what's hard to get your head around at first here is that the designer of the control has set certain constraints on that control. First, the designer of the control, the person who created the control, let's take one in particular that'll make it easier, and let's start with, for example, a button. So whoever designed the button said, this button has certain logic to it, and you cannot change the logic to it without creating a different kind of button through inheritance, that is, making a custom control. But let's say we don't want to make a custom control, we just want to use the button that we have. In that case, you can't change the logic of the button. So the button has a fixed set of events, and it has a fixed set of properties. That was designed by the designer.
So what would one of these events look like? Maybe when you click on the button, or?
Exactly. When you click on the button, the button raises the click event. It does not raise the scratch my nose event. And if you want it to raise the scratch my nose event, then you need to derive from it. Okay. And it has properties like it has width and height and text, but it does not have a property that keeps track of how many times it's been clicked. So if you would like a button that knows how many times it's been clicked, you need to derive from button and create one that has a property that keeps track of how many times it's been clicked. And so that's a key difference about using the button as it is versus deriving a derived class or a custom control that would extend the logic of the button. And by extending the logic, I mean either adding new events or adding new properties. But let's stay again with button. Now, separate from the logic are the visual aspects of button. And here again, the creator of the button has given you tremendous flexibility because of the lookless design. And let me make clear what that word is. That's L-O-O-K-L-E-S-S, lookless. The lookless design of the button. Let me explain how that works. What the designer of the button has said is this button has various states that it can be in. And you can find out what those states are in a couple ways. One thing that you can do is you can open up the Silverlight documentation and look up the button class. And if I look up the button class, what I find out is that what I really want is the button base class, because that's where the information is going to be. But I can also find the button class. And what I'm going to find out is that the states that the button supports, actually, I do want it in the button class itself, because I want to constrain myself to that, is unfocused, or else it is focused, mouse over, pressed, disabled, and normal. Now, it also turns out that to avoid an explosion of combinations, because you can imagine that I mouse over when I have the focus, and I mouse over when I don't have the focus, and this can get very complicated, there are what are called state groups. Focused and unfocused are in the focus states group, and pressed and disabled and normal are in the common states groups. That lets you separate these out, and the button can be at any given moment in any one state in each of the different groups. Now, those constraints were created by the designer of the button. So without creating a new type of button, you cannot change what states the button can be in. You can't say there's a new state for this button unless you make a new type of button. However, what the button does when it's in that state, how the button responds to being in the mouse over state, that you can change without deriving. And that is what templates are all about. So let's build up a little bit more slowly. First, we had setting attributes, right? So the simplest way you can change the look of a button is you can say, there's an attribute that I know this button class has, which is width. And I can set it to 50, 100, 150. That's going to change the look of the button, okay? And there's color and there's font and so on. And those all change the look of the button. Then the next thing you might say is you can say, you know, let's take text block. I use many of my text blocks as prompts. And I want all of my prompts to look a certain way. I want them to be bottom aligned, right aligned, but with a margin of 5 off the right side. I want them to use Verdana 14, and I want them to be blue in bold, and so on. And I don't want to have to keep writing that every time, so I can create a style which I can name prompt, and I can take that and place it in one of two places. I can either put it into my XAML page, for example, page.xaml or page2.xaml or mypage.xaml or whatever I want, put that into an area of that page, or I can take that and put it into app.xaml in the resource section. And then in my page, when I'm creating a text block, if I want it to be a label, I can set its style to refer to that resource. Now, in some ways, this is similar to CSS. In many ways, it's not. For example, you cannot take a style and build it as a variation of another style. So there's no derived styles and there's no cascading styles. But nonetheless, if you're building 20 prompts, you can give them all the same style. And that has, first of all, the advantage of making it much easier to set all of that. But secondly, and much more importantly, if you decide that, you know, I really want all my prompts to be 14 point instead of 12 point, you don't have to go then change it in 10 places. You change it in the style, and then they're all changed for you. So that's the next sort of level of taking control of the look and feel. And that stops. And if you go to silverlight.net, we have a tutorial on that, and we also have videos on that.
So styles are all about setting the properties on these different elements.
Exactly. It's just like setting the properties or attributes, more like setting the attributes in XAML by hand. This lets you take a cluster of them, say, here is what this cluster is, giving it a name, and then applying it to a number of those controls. Now, a given control, like a text block, you might have 3 or 4 different styles, or 20, for a text block. You might have a style called prompt. You might have a text block called data. You might, a style called data. And then when you use your text block as a prompt, you apply the prompt style. And when you use your text block to display data, you use the data style. And those might make your text block look very different, or align very different, or have different colors or whatever, just as you might use styles in HTML.
So I have these styles and I can apply them, say this prompt style, I can apply them to text blocks. Let's say I want most of the features of that style, but I want to override one piece of the style. Like I want, I want an alert prompt and I want my text to be read. How would I go about that?
Well, let me tell you what you can do, what you can't do.
Okay.
What you can do is you can go to the individual text block. And let me be clear, you can do this with text blocks or any other kind of control. You can do it with buttons and so on. And each style is targeted to a particular type of control. But going back to your question, let's say you have a style that is targeted at text blocks and you have a particular text block that you want to apply that style to, but you want it to be read, I think was your statement.
Yes.
You can go to that particular text block and just set its foreground color or background color, whatever it is you want to overwrite on that one text block or on three of them or however many you want, and that will take precedence. So it will apply the style, and then that will take precedence. So that you can do. What you can't do, and I don't want this to be confused, is you can't say, make a new style that is just like the other style, but override it in this way.
So my WPF friends who might be used to something like that, that's something they're not going to have in Silverlight.
Right. I think the people who tend to really notice it are the people who spend their life in CSS.
Right.
Because they're used to the idea of having many layers of override and derivation in styles. And we're not there at this point with Silverlight. Where we are is having essentially two layers. You've got styles that you can apply to your controls, and you can override it at the particular control. Now, Blend gives you tremendous support for this. You can create the style in Blend, which makes the work of creating the style a drag and drop, WYSIWYG, you know, click the various styles you want and save it. It's just a fast, easy, pleasurable experience. And secondly, applying those styles to controls is a drag and drop experience. You open up your resources, you find the style you want, you drag it over to the control, and you say, apply to this control. And it's an incredibly straightforward and easy experience. So Blend makes that much, much simpler. And I actually did a video called Green Eggs and Blend, which speaks to the question. I mean, if you remember the Dr. Seuss story about green eggs and ham, there are two main characters and one is saying, here, try this thing. And the other one is, no, I don't like it. And he finally tries it and says, I do like it. I do like green eggs and ham. And that was sort of my experience with Blend. You know, I spent 15 years trying to eliminate every ancillary tool so that I could work just in Visual Studio, and who wanted to add another tool to get my work done. But in fact, the combination of working in Visual Studio and Blend is so powerful that I now think of them as a single tool. And they're designed to work that way because there's no export and import. You open them on the same files. It is true that as you move from one to the other, you'll get a little quick notice saying these have been modified, and you have to say yes. And I would love to have a setting that says I always want yes, so don't even ask. I'll put that on my wish list. But what I do is I do all my UI, you know, dragging controls, setting properties in Blend, and I do all my code logic in Visual Studio, and it just makes life easy. So in any case, that's styles. Then the next step from that is what we were talking about when we talked about templates.
Yeah, so how do we tie these sort of worlds together, to styles and templates?
Sure. Templates are a way to say, take the entire appearance of this control and either give me a copy of everything you're doing to draw this control and let me modify it, or throw it out and I will draw the control any way I want. That's A. And B, tell me all the states the control can be in. Now, remember, those states were things like mouse over, normal, pressed, and so on. And I will tell you what the control should look like as a delta from what it looks like in its base state. That is to say, let's take a concrete example. Let's say I start with button. And instead of saying I want a copy of the button as the default look, I say, throw it away. I'm going to start from scratch. And in fact, I have a video in which we do exactly that. We throw away the button and we say, I'm going to make my own button. And what we do is we create a circle and we fill it with what's called a linear gradient. And I had one of the designers show me how to put in what looks like a little light spot, so it gives it a little sense of three dimension. It makes it kind of round, and it's very simple to do, and I show how to do that. And so now, instead of being a rectangle with words on it, it's round with words on it, and my button looks completely different. But buttons don't just sit there. When you move the mouse over them, they are supposed to change. Now, a standard button, if you move the mouse over it, it's rather subtle. It darkens slightly. And when you click it, it seems to indent. Well, it turns out that's not what I want my button to do. And I'm free to have it do anything I want. The only constraint is which states I get. So I can't not have mouse over and pressed unless I make a custom control. I have to have those states. I can't have any other states. But how it responds to those states, that's up to me. The way I tell it what I want it to do, the most common way, is as a change from its base position. Its base position is it's sitting there as an oval. So what I decided to do in this particular video was, when you mouse over it, it's going to swell a little bit. It's going to just grow a little bit in response. And it's very effective, because you mouse over and it goes, and it just sort of grows a little bit. And then when you press it, what I have it do is darken a little and shrink a little. And so it seems to be depressed into the screen. Okay. Now, I didn't have to do that, and in fact, we do one where we make it, instead of doing that, we make it twist and move away from you. And you can, I mean, all of these things are very, very easy to do, but the mechanism of doing them is not code. We don't raise an event and then run some code that says, move yourself in this way or so on. The mechanism is we create a storyboard, and in the storyboard, we describe the transition that we want. This is all XAML, and the visual state manager is responsible for knowing, and I'll explain in just a bit, how it does that. And as you move into the state, mouse over, it says, oh, I'm in this new state, so I need to run whatever storyboard you've associated with mouse over, and then that storyboard runs. So it's looking at the storyboard, which is declared in XAML, and running that storyboard. And there's no C# code running here to make that happen. And the last little bit, because moving from one state to another would feel very, very unnatural. You'd go from, you know, your regular state to the suddenly swollen state, and it would be just kind of cartoon-like. The Visual State Manager has built into it the concept of a transition. It says, oh, here's your starting position, here's your ending position. Tell me how long it should take to get from one to the other, typically 2/10, 3/10 of a second. And I will build all of the transition states in between so that it is very smooth. So instead of it going from state A to state B, boop, it transitions from one to the other very gently. And it does that for you if you're building this on an existing control. And now, what we haven't talked about, and we don't have to today, is the last step, which is, okay, even those constraints are too much. I want my own states, or I want my own logic, and that's when you get to custom controls.
Very interesting. So the sort of punchline here is that there are multiple ways of customizing controls, right? We have sort of low-pain ways of customizing controls that customize them just a little bit. And then we have ways of entirely changing the control appearance. And then we have the details of, you know, this involves the visual state manager, etc. One other thing that I hadn't really thought of, but I do want to highlight, and I think this is important, is if you want to change the look of a control, you don't have to touch the C# or VB code. You don't even have to touch the angle brackets, right? You can do this entirely in click and drag and drop and see what you get sort of interfaces.
I think that's key. Everything that I just described, from styles all the way through templates, you can do entirely in XAML by opening up the XAML files, or you can do in Blend in a design environment, in a WYSIWYG environment, and let Blend write the XAML for you. Now, most programmers get the willies when they hear the phrase, let X write the code for you. My experience so far is that the XAML that is written by Blend is either as good as or better than I would write myself, or if what we're looking at is path statements, And a path statement is when you want to create a shape that is a non-standard shape. You know, you're creating a free-form shape. And so there's a little pathing language in XAML that lets you say, start here and travel this far at this angle this much and then make a turn and so forth. And it's, you know, just lots of numbers. And nobody writes that by hand after the first time. You know, that's right, clearly right. Something you want machine done. So the net of that is that very quickly you find that either you use Blend or you hand it to someone else to do, because trying to write anything beyond a very, very simple template in pure XAML, other than for demonstration purposes, is an exercise in masochism. Now, we are living in a specific moment in history when the design surface in Visual Studio is read-only, which is to say that if you were working only in Visual Studio and you wanted to put a button onto the design surface, you would have to do that by changing the XAML, and you would immediately see it on the design surface. But unlike what we're used to in Visual Studio from ASP.NET or any of the other projects where you could just drag it onto the design surface, that's not implemented yet. That's coming, and certainly we're committed to it, but it's not implemented yet. And so if you want to be able to drag a button onto the design surface, you need a different tool. Blend is the obvious tool to use to do that.
Well, Jesse, this has been a tremendous overview of templates. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, I got to say, every time I'm on this show, I have a great time, and I'm looking forward to next month, and you are doing some great, great work for this community, so I very much appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much.